A moment of indecision put Anne-Marie Rindom's grip on the laser radial gold medal in jeopardy, but the Dane got her grin and her mojo back, and she did go on to win gold in Tokyo. So we'll be asking the new Olympic champion all about performing under pressure. But first, some of our usual introductions. Hi, I'm Andy Rice, coming to you from the UK. And with me is my Rota Gold partner in New Zealand, Hamish Wilcox. Hi, Hamish. How's things on a Thursday evening?
Really good, thanks. Good morning here in New Zealand. Oh, good morning over in Europe. Good evening here in New Zealand.
Well, we haven't got you very long today, Anne-Marie, so let's get you in while we can. So let's bring in the laser radial Olympic champion, Anne-Marie Rindom, and let's all give her a round of applause from wherever we are in the world. So, hi, Anne-Marie. Great to see you.
Great to see you guys. Thank you. And thank you for having me on the meeting.
So there's a lot we could ask you today, tell us how long do we have you, because you're off to where afterwards? You've got another appointment coming up soon, haven't you?
Oh yeah, I'm going to university. I'm still I missed one year of my master degree, so I'm trying to do that in between everything. It starts at 11 o'clock here in Europe, so
all right. Well, don't stay any longer than you can afford to. We don't want you to miss class. So that whole aspect of being a student as opposed to being a full-time sailor is something we might ask you about a little bit later on in the call. But let me ask you with a real basic question that everyone wants to know who hasn't won an Olympic gold medal. How does life change once you've won an Olympic gold medal?
Oh, it's actually very hard to describe. I mean, to actually achieve your lifelong goal is something that is just absolutely insane. It's overwhelming. It's fantastic. I'm so happy, and it's just, it's a weird feeling also that, you know, you fight for it for so long and then suddenly you are here and it's like, it's surreal. I don't know if my life has changed so much. I still go to school and I'm still busy, but it's definitely a weird period now as well, because there is not that goal that I work for every day. It's more in a period right now where I'm deciding what is next.
So what is immediately next is you've got to go off to class. So just tell us about what you're doing with your master's and how you've fitted that in and around the sailing over the last number of years.
Yeah, so I started my my degree back in 2012 after the London Games. And then I've been on and off for studies. And I study sports science. So, of course, there is a lot of things that I can use from my study in my sailing and also vice versa. And I think it's a great study. Next year, I'm doing like my masterpiece. I'm still not sure what I'm going to write about, but I'm very interested in like the mental preparation of training. So it's probably going to be something about sports psychology.
Now, I've got lots of questions to ask you, but I'm just going to remind you that the chat box is there for anybody to ask any question. It doesn't matter what level of sailing you're at. Every question is relevant. And sometimes the least experienced sailors ask the most interesting questions. Because some of us that have been in this game for as long as Hamish and I have forgotten what we once didn't know, if you know what I mean. So even if you've got what you think might be a silly question, don't hold back. But let me ask you this, Anne-Marie. At the mix zone, the opportunity every day that I had in Tokyo to interview you and the other sailors, what comes across to me about you is that you wear your heart on your sleeve. You're a very emotional athlete. So what we're doing as journalists is we're always trying to bring out the highs and lows out of you. When you've had a really good day, we're trying to slap you on the back and say, hey, Anne-Marie, that was amazing. You can go out and celebrate tonight. And most athletes will say, no, got to keep it on the level, you know, take it race by race. And then if you've had a really bad race, we'll say, oh, you must feel terrible. And you'll say, no, got to keep it on the level, take it race by race. But you give a lot more in your interviews, and it seems like you almost can't help yourself, that it was almost a release of emotion at the end of the day. But that's my interpretation. How do you think you come across, and what's going on for you emotionally?
I think for me, and during the Olympics, it's important for me, and it's one of my values to show all, like, when you're doing good, but also when you're doing not so good, and actually tell the story and to be like true to your values and just show all the emotions that you're feeling, because I think people at home watching, and especially at this Olympics where I couldn't have my friends and family there, it was important to me to show what was actually happening out there emotional, and not just only just tell the story, oh, this happened, but actually get some feelings at the interviews by the end of the day, to get more out to people and show who I am.
So that's an extra level of commitment that you've made over and above actually performing on the water. Is that something you had to tell yourself to do, or does that come naturally for you to be so open with the story and your emotions?
Well, I think I definitely learned it over the years to be more, to teach myself how to explain those feelings, so people at home can follow. But I think it also comes natural to me that it's not that I don't put any filter on, because of course I also, there is some things that I don't want to say in the interview, but to tell the story and tell the truth and show some emotions, I think a lot of people can relate to, if you follow a big sports star, you kind of have this picture that they just are super confident and they just go into a sailing or a match and being super confident. But I don't think that that's the truth. I think everybody is super nervous, and even though they've done that a million times, I think they are having a lot of emotions going through their head. They are nervous and the adrenaline is rushing, and I think it's important to put words on that.
Well, clearly you built up a big fan base, and I see some of your fans on this call with us now, and I see Lottie is on the call. Now, Lottie, if you want to come in and ask a question, you'd be very welcome. If you don't want to, that's fine too. But I'm just going to, would you love to? Well, unmute your microphone and Lottie, come in and say hi to Anne-Marie.
Hello. I'm not sure if you saw my message, but I was wondering, because we're in lockdown, what would you do? Because we can't really sail.
Ooh, that's a hard question. And hey, Lottie, nice to see you here. Well, we were in lockdown 1.5 years ago, and what I was doing was just playing video games, actually. I was doing that for quite a while, but of course I was also trying to keep my training up and just trying to do some exercise, trying to be active. I was also playing this virtual skipper thing I'm not sure what it's called, but I was playing with my friends. So we put up a race every night after dinner. We did some races, and I think that's very good for sailing. So maybe think about that.
Oh, I have that.
Yeah. Good. It's a great tool to still be learning about sailing.
Well, thank you. Lottie, lovely to get you on, and a great question. And if I can just crowbar in a mention of Road to Gold as well, as a great thing to do to advance your sailing when you can't get on the water. So Anne-Marie, I've given you a login into Road to Gold, but you probably haven't had a chance to look at it in amongst all your study. But we'll drop a link into the chat box for anyone that wants to look at it, because the whole ethos of what Hamish has put together with Road to Gold is to point out the fact that you can get so much done, even when you can't get on the water. So keep those questions coming. I see that we've got some good ones coming in already. So I'm not going to take these necessarily in order, but let's see if Piotr, and excuse me about the pronunciation, but Piotr, do you want to come in and ask your question about mental preparation? Let's see if we can bring you in. I'm just going to give Piotr a moment. And and let's see, I'll ask the question anyway. So Amory, do you have any kind of mental preparation as a plan? And if so, what is it and when do you start? So I guess this is about your mental routines for any given day.
Yeah, okay. So after, when I started sailing, I wasn't paying attention so much to mental preparation. I think that at that point, it was not as important as it is now. I think the more and more, like the higher level you get up to, the more important it gets. And it's, you know, it's easy actually to tick all the boxes about physical preparation because you can measure it all the time. Like you can go down in the gym, you can measure how strong you are, but with mental preparation it's a little bit different. It's something that is more blurry, but to have some routines is very important, and what I work with my sports psychologist is doing small exercises. So every day doing 5 to 10 minutes of mindful. I have an app on my phone, and what I actually just, it's very basic, but to register what where am I now, where, what kind of thoughts do I have, what kind of feelings do I have, and then practicing on releasing those feelings and then coming back to a refocus. And that could, for example, be just focus on the breathing. So small exercises like that. And then of course I also do exercises on the water. So we have this kind of like a game, or it's where you have the different clips, I think it's called in English, where I have a circle and it's called the concentration circle. And in the middle, there is a blue one. And that means that you are completely in the flow. Everything is going well for you. You are in the moment. You are focused on what you need to focus on the water. And that's the blue thing you put on your life jacket. And then there is different colors to different states of where you are right now. So for example, if you're thinking about what to have for dinner, or you're thinking about an assignment you have to do for tomorrow's school, you are completely out in the outer circle. That could be a gray one. And then you put that on the life jacket. So actually you're practicing on just realizing where you are. Are you here now or are you somewhere else? And then there's different colors for that. So that could be a small exercise to do as well. But I think practically what we did during the Olympics is that we did small exercises in the morning. So we had like a routine where me and my sports psychologist, we were talking about what's going to happen on the water. Like what are, just having like a conversation about what kind of feelings do I have right now? Am I nervous or I'm excited, or, you know, what am I most nervous about? And then putting some words on that to have a conversation about that. And then we do a small little mind exercise where he is kind of putting a scenario up where everything is not going well on the water. So I'm preparing myself to be in a hard situation. So instead of like, imagine it's going well, because I think everyone, it's easy for everyone when it's going really good. But what is tricky is when it's going not so good. So we're kind of preparing all these scenarios where it could go wrong and then trying to get out of it. But this is just practicing in the mind.
Thank you, Amory. Now, someone is typing furiously in the background and it sounds like they're very quick and I want to hire them as my secretary. But if you could just check that you're on mute, if you are somebody doing a lot of typing right now, because we're just hearing it come through on the microphone. Hamish, what are your observations so far about what Amory said? And I particularly like this idea about the different color circles on the life jacket.
Yeah, no, it's really great, that visual reinforcement. We talked a little bit about that with the red and the blue, and the blue being, you know, like in control and the red being very out of control and trying to be somewhere in between. But I was really interested to hear you talk about the parents and the supporters and family not being able to attend in Japan. And I'm wondering, do you think that was a hindrance or help in your case? And would you have had to put some more preparation into your psychology, just knowing that you had parents and family and friends there and making sure they were okay? And or would that have, you know, where was it sitting on the balance sheet? Because this is the first Olympics we've been to where we haven't had family and friends at.
I think that, I could have dealt with it. Sorry. I think I could have dealt with it no matter where, if they were home or there. I think the preparation would definitely be different. But I think in terms of thinking about, you know, my family and friends are not normally at regattas. So actually, it was easier because I didn't have to think that they were there. And I didn't feel that responsibility of, after racing, going over to, we have like a meeting point with the Danish team and going over and say hello. I think we managed to do pretty well in Rio, where it was a good balance between saying hi to the family, but also being fully present in the competition. But I think it was easier in that way, yeah, because there is not so many people that you have to be with.
Thanks.
Anne-Marie, one of the conversations that I really wanted to get in further with you, one of our brief ones at the Mix Zone, was you talked about how sometimes your emotions can start driving the bus. And you've got to make sure that that's you who's in charge of driving the bus and that your emotions are back in the passenger seat. Do I have that right? I'd just love to hear a little bit more about the bus analogy that you use.
Yeah, so this bus that I'm thinking that I talked about is like a mental kind of picture that I have. So it's the picture where you have to imagine that you're the driver of this bus, and you know, you are in charge of where you are going, and then all the passenger is your thoughts and your feelings. So it could be a feeling that, you know, you see some of the other sailors and they are sailing really fast, so you're thinking, oh no, they're sailing so fast. Or it could be, well, I'm actually a little bit insecure of if I've been training enough, am I strong enough? Or it could be if you're on the starting line and you think that it's a little bit scary to start at the pennant, for example, because all the good sailors are down there. So all these like negative thoughts, I guess, but it can also be positive thoughts. They are the passenger of the bus, and you have to just say to them, you know, you're welcome in the bus to drive with me. So instead of pushing them out and saying, you know, I'm driving this bus alone, just welcome them and say, it's fine that you are there, but I'm still deciding where we're going. And they can come up and they can pull you around and say, hey, we should take this exit, or you should stop by my house. But you're saying you have to be good enough to say, you know, and no, not get affected by them and say, I'm going to drive this way because this is a part of the plan. This is the plan that I made with my coach, and I'm going to stick to that, even though they are pulling you around. So this is kind of like a picture that, yeah, it can help you just release those negative thoughts.
So Greg has got a great question. And so Greg in Cape Town, if you want to come in and ask that question, I wonder who was driving the bus towards the end of the regatta in the Olympics. That's relevant to the part of the regatta that Greg wants to ask about. So I'm just going to see if Greg can come in.
Hi there. Thanks, Andy. Am I coming across loud and clear?
Yes, you are. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. Hi. So first of all, Emery, congratulations. Wonderful results. You know, super stuff. What I'm particularly interested to know is that, you know, in any regatta, you go through a sets of highs and lows, obviously. I mean, given the level of competition. And your races from 1 to 8 were really nice and consistent, which is what basically put you up there, probably obviously more consistent than any of your other competitors. But your 9 and 10 races were obviously not what you were hoping for. So the final medal race, there must have been huge pressure. So while you were obviously doing a lot of mental prep and you described some of that, it'd be really interesting to understand what were you really thinking and feeling leading up to the medal race? And was there anything specifically, you know, going into that race in terms of a plan about how you approached that race from a mental prep point of view? It would just really be lovely to get into your head to understand, you know, what was going, what you were thinking and feeling Over to you.
Yeah. Thank you for asking that question. It's very hard to answer that question because, you know, going into that Friday, we call it Black Friday over here, and that was a day where I could finish the Olympics. I could finish with a gold medal. And I think going into that day, knowing that and putting so much pressure on myself was, that was a hard thing to deal with. And that's probably also why it didn't go so well. but it is hard to exactly know what was happening that day. I think after when I finished the day and it didn't go very well and I dropped from 22 points lead to 7 points lead, I think it was important to find into the core that I was actually still leading. And even though I felt defeated and I felt like that I lost, I had to come up with, I had to pull myself together and say, hey, if I knew before the Olympics that I would be leading with 7 points going into the medal race, I would probably be pretty happy about that. So that was important for me. And what we did was we talked over all the scenarios going into the medal race. So, of course, I did a mistake on Friday, not knowing the rule that I could actually continue in the second race after getting the second yellow flag. And I still punched myself over that. But I also have to say to myself, I'm only a human being. Nobody's perfect. And it's a little bit of a comfort that I haven't met many sailors yet who knew about this rule. And that's helping me a little bit to get over it. But I think what we did particularly was that we talked it through. We talked the whole day through. We pointed fingers at each other. We screamed, we cried, we laughed on that Friday evening. And then on Saturday, we just prepared all the scenarios. So if Marit did this, if Josephine did that, if they did this, I should act like this. And I think we came up with like 7 different scenarios on how to act if they were doing that. And that helped me being a little bit more calm in, I knew exactly what the plan was gonna be going into that medal race.
Great.
I hope it's enough answer.
that was an incredible day. And the thing was that we had those cameras mounted on the at the front of the laser so we could see all your emotions. And I heard a few words that I could recognize from the English language as well, but I wonder if they were imported with the Viking invasions many centuries ago. We seem to have the same words of frustration. It was emotional for anyone that was following your story. And how long did it take for you to turn around that feeling that it was defeat, but actually to realize, as you just said, that it was you were still going into the medal race with a 7-point advantage? I'm just wondering, you know, how much turning around of the emotions did that take, and how much was the bus out of control?
The bus was completely out of control that day, and I'm not going to lie, it was also escalating. You know, the preparation going into the Friday was as normal. I come to the race course and my compass doesn't work, and I think that's one of the first things that triggers a little bit, and then it just becomes like this negative spiral that is just, it's actually a good start in the first race. And then I go out kind of alone. So a little bit away from the plan that we made, me and my coach, that I should follow the fleet, but I really didn't. But I was actually still in the leading pack. But then everything just starts to go more and more wrong. And I find myself in a little bit of a behind position on the downwind, getting my first yellow flag, getting even more behind. And then not finishing the race very good. And because we have so little time between the races to talk to my coach, I didn't really get over the first race. And then going into the second race, just being a little bit too excited about everything and being a little bit too many emotions in my body. And that feeling that I could finish it that day, that feeling just pulled me so much in a negative direction instead of just calming down, you know, take a deep breath and just focusing on the things that was important to sail fast and get a good start with no traffic. But instead, I go up and I get myself in a trouble, in a hard position with Marit at the pennant, and the jury is right behind us, and I get a second yellow flag. That was just, you know, it was just like a negative spiral. The whole day was just, it was escalating too much, and it was hard to pull myself out from that.
Jeff has a question about yellow flag penalty. So Jeff, please come in and ask that if you like. But Anne-Marie, if you could have your time again, and knowing the point situation, would you still go on the attack with Marit at the start? And even, you know, let's say you executed it better and you didn't get the yellow flag. Was that the right strategy?
I definitely think it was. We've been talking about it, and of course it's easy to say now that I should just have stayed out of trouble and just start a little bit higher up on the line where there was not so much risk. But actually, when we've also been talking about it, is that for me, it's, I've done so many pennant starts, so for me it's actually not a big risk to go down and take the pennant start because I've done it so many times. And in a normal race where the pressure is maybe a little bit lower, it wouldn't have been a problem because there was so much pressure on me that day and I put a lot of pressure on myself, it was just really hard to execute.
We've got a lot of questions coming in, and Lottie, somehow on Zoom, you found a way of putting a yellow hand up. So I've never even discovered that before, but Lottie, you've got a great question, which is relevant to this. So please come and ask your question to Anne-Marie.
What's your favorite quote? And like when you, I think you've kind of covered this already, but what do you say to yourself when you're not doing as well as you want to?
I think a good quote that I'm working with right now is, perfect is the enemy of good. And that means that nobody's perfect and you don't have to be doing perfect races because you don't have to win every race in a regatta. You can just have good enough races and you can still win by the end of the day. So I think that's a very good quote. Perfect is the good, it's the enemy of good.
Thank you. Could you please send me your virtual regatta username?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Lottie, very quickly, what do you sail and what are your ambitions for your sailing?
Well, I sail an Opti and I want to go to the 2032 Olympics in Brisbane.
Amazing, amazing. Well, people who make those statements early on in life and really mean it, they often end up being the ones that end up doing it. Is that not right, Anne-Marie?
Yeah, exactly.
So amazing ambition. Thank you, Lottie. We got so many questions coming in. I'm going to go to Jeff because Jeff has found a way of putting up his yellow hand. And yes, Guy, I am old. That's why I don't know where to find the yellow hands. So maybe somebody like Lottie can help me. But Jeff, you come in and ask your question.
Hi, Anne-Marie. I was just wondering on your thoughts on the yellow flags, whether the penalty is a bit too harsh for such a subjective thing, whether it should be just maybe one turn.
I think we've got. Sorry, Jeff. Sorry, Jeff, you go back on. That'd be great.
I think I could hear myself on echo right now. I don't know what happens, but maybe
it's okay again now. I think. Yeah. Thank you for that, Jeff.
So whether it's the penalty is too hard or not, I really don't think so. I think two spins is okay, and I think that for what I did on the downwind, pumping a little bit too much, I think it was definitely I definitely deserved that one. Also in the start, looking at the video now, I can see that I was sculling too much. Also deserves. Should Marit have got a yellow flag as well? Maybe, but they chose to give me a yellow flag. So I definitely think that I deserved that.
Well, I was thinking though, having to retire after the second yellow flag. It's like the old days when we used to hit a mark, we had to retire.
Oh wow, I didn't know that. Well, it's it's very hard for me to answer, actually. I guess I'm thinking that that's how the rule is, and we are used to going out after the second yellow flag. I definitely think that the rules should be a little bit more that it's the same at every regatta, so it shouldn't change. So if there is a general recall, maybe you should always be able to go back in the race, but it seems to change from regatta to regatta.
Yeah, that consistency issue is a real problem, and Hamish and I have spoken about that with other guests since the end of Tokyo, and we've saw a lot more Rule 42 applied to the skiff classes than they're used to getting at other events. And so that is a real problem and hard for an athlete to prepare for. But yeah, I watch your racing and I watch the laser and the fin racing, and I'm always worried in light winds where who's going to get the finger of doom pointed at them. It's quite scary. I'm going to keep on going with other people's questions. And sorry, Bruce, because I've left your questions for a long time. But Bruce, if you're still around and you want to come in and ask a question, you've got a very technical one about the carbon bottom section. I don't want to stay too long on that, but if you're around, do come in and ask that. And if not, I will very quickly ask Bruce's questions for him. So how do you think the new radial carbon bottom section will affect the way the boat is sailed, Anne-Marie?
Well, I was so lucky that I had 1 year now where the carbon sections was actually in. And I think they're great. I think it create more dynamic to the whole mast. We saw that after the carbon top section came in, the weight actually went a little bit up in the radial. And now it seems like if the bottom is coming in, it could go down a little bit again, which I think it's great, because if you're not that tall, it's actually pretty hard to be 70 or 72. I think that's the way it will affect it. And of course, also in a way where you don't have to buy 10 masts every second year, because they are bending. They seem to last really good. So maybe we'll see that we're just having one mast from now on, which is good for the environment as well.
That's very true. Now, Bruce's other question, what did you learn from your second place finish on the final day at the 2020 European Champs that helped you get the job done in Tokyo this year? So I don't know the background of that story. Bruce sounds like he knows your career pretty well. What happened on that day?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that he asked this question, because this is also normally a regatta that I tell people about after coming back from Tokyo. And last year at the 2020 Europeans in Poland, I was leading with 22 points going into the last day. And we had two races. I just had to finish top 14 and I would win. But I didn't manage to do that. It was windy, it was wavy, it was my favorite conditions. But I just saw myself completely falling apart. And I learned a lot from that day. And I was happy that it happened last year. And that's also why when I didn't have a good day on that Black Friday, I couldn't believe that it was happening to me again. After 8 months and not learning anything about what happened at the European Championship last year, I just couldn't believe it. But what I had to come back and remembering was that it wasn't over in Tokyo. Because I got saved from the first 4 days that I sailed so well, I was actually able to still be 7 points ahead. And that was my luck, or how I can say it's going into the medal race, because I was still leading with 7 points. But at the Europeans, I paid the price. I wasn't able to come back because that was our last day, because we don't sail medal race.
Now, do you know what I mean by choking? It's a pretty mean term that's used in sport. For people that are obviously world-class but don't seem to come through when it matters the most. Was that a choke at the Europeans? I obviously you learned from it, but was it a choke at the time?
Oh, 100%. 100%. It was the toughest day. I was seemed to focus on all the wrong things. I think one of the things that was actually the worst, was that I was focusing so much about being in top 14, and I just saw myself being 10th at the top mark, and instead of gaining on the downwind, I lost a lot of boats, and I didn't seem to be able to just figuring it out and sailing fast. And if you don't have the speed, if you feel like you're going backwards, it's pretty hard to finish top 14. So that was what happened that day. It was just it was a matter of speed.
Some athletes, when that happens to them, they say to themselves, "Oh, maybe I just don't have that final X factor. Maybe it's, you know, it's not my destiny to, you know, to have that thing," because you can't really learn how to overcome that sense of choking. Clearly, you don't believe that. Clearly, you look at every opportunity as a learning opportunity, and you're even studying this at a master's level. So at the time, it must have been very painful. But when did you manage to embrace that as a learning experience?
It was very hard to see myself going from going from the first position to the second. And I think if you have a long career of sailing, now I've been sailing the laser for 12 years, and you know, in sport there will be ups and downs, and what defines you as a person is also how you come back from your sort of like the downers. If you are find yourself in a position where you're not doing good, you know, if you find your way to get back, I think that defines you as a person. So there's much more to it than just results in a long career path. And there will be up and down, and you just have to realize that you cannot win it all. But I know that I'm also experienced enough to kind of know that I will be coming back and I will bounce back from it. So just take all these opportunities to learn.
I want to come back to you on that subject, but I'm going to keep the questions going. And Jenny Armstrong, who I think has had to leave the building, but I'm always bringing Jenny in on the call. So I should do the honourable thing and ask her question, even though she may not be here. She would love to hear what your advice would be to a top 20 laser radial sailor to move up to the podium. And actually, I'm sure we've got quite a few people on the call that are wondering that same question. So what is that difference that gets you from top 20 to the podium?
I guess it's a lot of things. I mean, hard training, you come a long way with that practice. I think it's such an underrated statement of if you practice and practice and practice, you will get there at some point. And being in an elite sport on the top level is all about practice. And I think that's one of the things that I've done the most of all the laser sailors in the world is to practice the most. So having that discipline to just chip away every single day, find some ways where you can get better at something.
Well, as Hamish points out on Road to Gold, there's practice and then there's practice. You know, there's this, you can use your practice time effectively, or you can waste it doing the things that you're already good at, polishing the what's already the shiny side of your vase and ignoring the dusty side of the vase. So just tell us about effective practice and time, making best use of time.
Yeah, so it's always important to work on the right things. And what we seem to work on is always the things that we are already good at, because they feel good to work on. But to find those things where it feels maybe a little bit unpleasant. For me, it's been the last couple of years, cardio training. I hate cardio. I used to hate cardio training. But it was just one of those things that I had to work on. So I got a new coach and he made a program, and just getting through that program and doing that, because I knew that that's going to get me closer to my goal about winning an Olympic medal. So, you know, it's it's always hard to pick those things. And that's why you have coaches or you have training partners. And for example, asking your training partners, because they know you pretty well. Somebody once told me, and if you ask them, what do you think I'm not so good at? If you're having a hard time figuring out what should I work on, and they will be able to tell you, and then you know, start working on those things. And if you need help, then ask.
People generally give you an answer, as Hamish often says. You know, you can ask what you think is a cheeky question, and you often get a very good answer back. Just tell me about your training group and how that worked, who you were working with, and what the process was.
So we are three girls from Denmark. Two of them is aiming to go to the Olympics in Paris. That's their goal, and they're quite young. And when COVID hits, we were able to get a group, like a very good group here in Denmark, and just training together. And we are, you know, almost like sisters now, because we spend so much time together. And just to be able to share that knowledge with them, not even that they motivated me to get like one more year of sailing towards the Olympics and pushing me. But I was also able to, you know, train with them for one more year and giving them all the advices that I could to be able to prepare them for the next campaign. And I think that's one of the big values in Danish sailing, that our shortest way to the top is to help each other as much as possible. So even though there's only one person who can go to the Olympics, it's not thinking about that, but more thinking about, you know, how can I get these two girls up to my level as fast as possible so they can push me to become better. That was our goal the last couple of years, and especially last year where we only had each other.
So that sense of sharing everything and wanting to help everyone along, how much is that driven by the Danish Sailing Federation, or how much of that is just a natural trait of Danish people?
Oh, it's definitely how we grew up in Danish sailing sport, like that culture about sharing knowledge and help each other and also, you know, always helping them who was the least fastest in the group. Of course, there is different ways to do it. So I mean, if we are far away from the Olympics, it's more focusing on the new ones in the laser group. But then as we move along and closer to the Olympics, of course, it's going to be more focusing on performing at the Olympics. But I think we have a very good balance on the training group, so everybody feels like they're getting something out of it. But it's also a part of being a Danish person, I guess.
Our right, well,
is to, if that we have a saying, for example, where I come from in my sailing, from my sailing club Horsens, that we kind of lift each other together. I don't know exactly how it's said in English, but yeah, we all lift each other because then it's easier.
Amazing. Well, Hamish, do you remember in one of our first Q&A calls many months ago, one of the questions was in the training group, if I'm faster than other people in strong winds, why, what's in it for me to share that knowledge? And here we've got Anne-Marie saying the opposite, that whoever's the weakest or the slowest in the group is the one that gets the most attention. That sort of approach is not obvious to everyone, is it?
But it's something definitely, you know, I've been harping on about right through every chapter of Road to Gold, is that, you know, you've got to have a training group and you've got to work together. And it's going to be really cool, Anne-Marie, because next week we've got JJ and Andy, you know, two gold medals and the Finn Gold Cup in consecutive years, talking about just that, you know. So I totally 100% with you, you know, the fact that you've done so well is a result of all that hard training you did with a really good little squad during the COVID, and you probably had it, you know, organized better than anyone else, is my guess.
Well, Anne-Marie, the way that you're talking, it sounds like you're not going around again for Paris 2024. Is that the case, that you've effectively retired from Olympic campaigning?
I'm still deciding whether I should go back or not to the laser or continue, yeah. I must say there is only 3.5 years to the next Olympics, and that is tempting to go back. But I'm also looking for new challenges and how I can keep it together. It's you definitely not become rich by sailing. So I mean, looking for different projects would also be a good challenge for me. But I do enjoy laser sailing. I think it's maybe not the fastest boat out there, but it's just such a great boat to learn tactics, strategy. Just good sailing qualities you learn from the laser. So I would be very sad to not come back for the next Olympics.
Good. Well, I sort of took it off the table and you've sort of put it back on the table there, which is good. Because when I asked the three medalists who's at the press conference, and you've barely got the medal round your neck, and I asked that nasty question, who's coming back for Paris? Only one of you stuck their hand up, and I'm sure you remember who that was. It was the bronze medalist Marit Bouwmeester. So there was an extraordinary moment in that, and I'm sure you remember it, where Marit effectively said, or I asked her the question in such a way that she said she'd only won one medal. Now, you know that she's won three. She's won a silver, a gold, and a bronze at the last three games. But she only counts the gold from Rio 2016. What was your feeling at the time, and what do you take from Marit's sort of all or nothing approach to excellence?
I think it's so challenging, and there are so many girls who can do it good at the Olympics, and to be able to win the Olympics until the last race, I think your goal has been achieved at that point. It's very hard for me to describe, but I think you should be satisfied with be able to win before the last race. I think that's been my goal, and then everything can happen in middle race. And sometimes it turns out to your advantage, and sometimes it doesn't.
It's quite different, your approach to it, and it's interesting that you both end up at a very similar level, even though you seem to come to the problem from very different points of view. Anyway, she says she's definitely back in. I'm delighted to hear that you are still thinking about coming back in.
I think it's also that Olympic kind of feelings that you have in you when Olympics is over. I'm not gonna lie, I was also thinking I'm gonna be back for sure, I'm gonna be back. But once you get back to your home country and in your daily routine and everything kind of settles down, it's so much work to go to the Olympics. It's so many emotions you have to go through, and it's not only about the Olympics, because the Olympics is 1 week where you sail. It's about all these days that you have to enjoy. You have to like really, really just go and enjoy the process of it, because that's the most important thing. Because if I ended up with a silver, I would be so disappointed, but it would still be worth it, because the road to that week of sailing was worth it.
Nice. You've stolen my heart there, Marie. Nice work. I 100% agree with that. Could you tell me a little bit about the language you must have developed? Because it sounds like you have a very good ability to talk about the psychology of winning and the psychology of just getting through your training day by day. And you've obviously developed a pretty good language around it. And to me, you said, or somebody said earlier, it's quite hard to measure success in this area, unlike the gym or other parts. And so tell me a little bit about how you developed that language with your training partners, so you could talk about it, and also with your coach, and then how you set yourself measures, so maybe you put yourself under pressure in training in order to see if you're successful or not with how you're performing under pressure.
Yeah, so it's something that, it's coming over the years more and more and more. And I have like conversations with my sports psychologist on putting words on describing how I'm feeling and what kind of thoughts there is. And everybody can be insecure about whether they can perform or not. And actually, the more you get into your career, the more pressure you put on yourself, because if you don't perform, it's like, all right, but then what's going to happen then? Where if you're young, the feeling is, okay, if you don't perform, it's okay, you're still young, you still have a lot of years, and if you perform, everybody's super happy. But it's kind of like you can't win the more you come into your career. If you don't perform, everything is just so bad. But if you perform, everybody expected that anyway. So it's not like they're like, yay. So I think what we talked a lot about on our team is values. What kind of values do you want to have as a sailor? And actually, a good exercise is to what do you want people to say in a speech to you after a regatta or after your career? Do you want to have them to say, yeah, she did this and this and this and this result and she was gold here and here? Or do you want to have people to say, you know, Emery, she was a brave sailor. She won the respect of her competitors. She was able to take some decisions that nobody else was able to take. And, you know, all these kind of like different values, they're so important to define who you are. And it's not the same for everybody. But it's just so important to know them. And it takes years. It's not something that you will just realize within the first couple of years of your sailing career. It's something that you have to feel and get to at some point in your career. And those are the values you can come back to if you, for example, don't perform.
Yeah, really nice. Yeah, thank you.
There's a number of questions that I haven't addressed. And so Andreas, Benedict, Finn are three names that come to mind. Just ask your question again at the bottom of the chat box, if you don't mind, and see who puts their hand up a second time to get those questions answered. Anne-Marie, let me ask you a question. I mean, we got some way to understanding your own values, but how do you want to be spoken about in years to come?
Well, I definitely think one of the most important thing is to be brave. I think to be able to go into a medal race and show your bravest self, how do you say it, is the most important thing for me. Because it's hard. It's so many emotions that is filling you, and you are so nervous and it feels uncomfortable. Because it's just uncomfortable to be in when it's a competition that means a lot to you. So yeah, be able to be brave enough, and a situation could be that you are brave enough to take the pin and that you don't chicken away because it feels unpleasant, you know. Go for it because you know that you can do it, been training for it for a long time.
And so this is a sort of a dilemma that faces a lot of Olympic sailors in medal races. Do you sail safe for the silver because you know that if you sail conservatively for the silver, you can do that? Or do you put it all on the line for the gold? What kind of sailor are you in that situation?
Well, of course, it also depends on the context. But I mean, I without sounding like I'm the best, I kind of knew that I was the best that week. I just knew within myself that I was sailing so well. I was sailing super fast. So I definitely went for it in middle race. And yeah.
Yeah. So it was about the gold. Yeah. Okay. It's PJ Posma, the Dutch Finn sailor in that at the end of that London 2012 medal race, where he took a risk and he went all out for gold and ended up with nothing. He ended up with fourth place, I think it was, but it could have ended up so differently. And yet he says he has no regrets on that. So it was sort of that kind of scenario I was thinking of. Incredibly brave.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also, you know, a skill that you need to have. You need to know when to take risk and when to not.
Thank you. We've got another couple of questions come in, but I'm going to honour the ones that came in earlier. So, Finn, if you'd like to come in and ask your question about the lead up to Tokyo, that would be great. Let's see if we can get Finn to come in and ask that question. No, okay. So I will ask the question for Finn, broken microphone. So this is a preparation thing, and it makes me think about the lack of training time on the Olympic waters. So Finn asked, what did the days leading up to the Olympics look like? How much were you actually training out on the water?
We decided to go to Lanzarote, which is, I found the place that was kind of similar to Japan as much as possible, but without traveling outside of Europe. So we went there and we were actually training. I think I was maybe training 5 days a week in average. So 5 days a week and then having weekends off. But what we did was that we went for quality and not quantity. So instead of having 4 hour sessions on the water, it was more like 2 hour sessions. So more high quality and and then also it was also with the physical preparation, it was also less time, so just getting more and more fresh and having that feeling that the body was just like in a really good shape to just execute whenever we had those 2 hours in the water, and then having a break and then doing physical preparation in the afternoon.
Have we got enough time for one more question with you, Anne-Marie? Because I know you need to run soon.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask Benedict to come in and ask his question about mental preparation and also it's basically using one mind to address two very different problems, I think, is what you're getting at, Benedict. Let's see if we can get you in.
Yeah. Hey, guys. I just had a question about how you balance out the mental preparation in terms of being calm, confident on the water, and then preparing yourself for the conditions. So things like wind shifts and sea states, like do you have a time that you switch mindsets kind of thing?
So in terms of like mental preparation, I mean, what we do before going out on the water is that we talk about what kind of conditions do we have today? Is it a day where the wind is coming from inside, where, you know, you have to be aware and looking out of the boat? Like what kind of, like, we call it blue focus. So what is the most important thing today? Okay, if it's coming from inshore wind, you just need to look out of the boat. And there is a saying that if you look out of the boat, you're already in front of half of the fleet. Because nobody's looking out, that everybody's looking inside the boat. So if you can do that, that's just super, super important. If it's coming onshore, maybe not so important to look out because we know it's not gonna shift as much. So maybe that's just more about looking inside the boat, getting the boat up to speed. It's more of a speed game. So these kind of scenarios, we are talking about that before we go on the water and what kind of... what kind of situations we have out there today. And maybe it's going to change. And I'm not bringing my mental coach out on the water, but then my sailing coach is also on top of it. Like, what are we focusing on today? And then just having three different things. So three different blue focus points that you know is going to, that you can always come back to is very important.
Thank you.
Great question, Benedict. And that is going to be the last question. Normally, we have time to get all of them in, but you've had so many for me today. I'm afraid I've not been able to address them all today. And Maura, I'd have loved to have brought you in, one of those radial sailors aspiring to follow in Anne-Marie's footsteps. Hamish, any final comments from you?
No, I really loved it. Thanks so much. And congratulations on an awesome result and obviously a great 5 years of training. And wishing you well if you go on.
Thank you so much.
Then Anne-Marie, you're always so generous with the way that you speak, and you explained the reasons for that. It's not just about the results on the water, it's presenting who you are as a person and being a role model. So we thank you for that, and we thank all the questioners today, and particularly Lottie Griffith, for asking your questions, Lottie, and for showing me the golden hand in Zoom, which I haven't discovered over the last year. So goes to show that every day is a learning day. And Amory, I know you've got to rush away. Thank you so much. We hope to do this again with you sometime. And I want you to tell me as soon as you've decided that you're going to do a Paris 2024 campaign as well. So
pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you're interested in the Road to Gold program, we've just dropped something into the chat box, roadtogold.net. You can find out more and you can get the recordings of these calls as well. But that's it for the time being. Hamish and I will be back to you in a week's time when we have two of the best fin sailors in the world, America's Cup winners, JJ and Andy. So we're going to have a real good call next week. It's going to be a hard act to follow after Amory, but maybe they'll be up to it. We'll see. We've learned so much from you. Thank you, Amory. And we will catch up with everybody on this call in a week's time. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.